This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for March 25th, 2021, the unfulfilled edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast in Washington, D.C. We launched CityCast Denver this morning, Thursday morning. I'm going to talk more about CityCast next week, but check out CityCast Denver if you're in Denver or love Denver. It's a daily podcast and newsletter. I am joined by John Dickerson of CBS's 60 Minutes from New York. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And by an extremely jacked up Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School. I cannot wait for the Emily Bazelon of today's show. Wait,
you're totally ruining my expectation.
I really am like way too animated this morning. It's true. It's because I missed you guys. I have 2 weeks of like energy to expel.
Listeners, buckle up.
Watch
Here
out.
Here we go. On today's GabFest, we'll talk about the immigration crisis. Is there an immigration crisis at the southern border and elsewhere in the United States? Then we're going to talk about violence and harassment of Asian Americans in the wake of the murders in Atlanta and data suggesting incidents against Asian Americans have risen dramatically in the last year. And we're going to talk to Professor Claire Jean Kim of the University of California, Irvine, about that. Then we're going to be joined by Alec McGillis to talk about his book Fulfillment, which is about Amazon and Amazon's effect on the United States and the Amazon union fight and what that tells us about the state of America. Plus, what a gaffe on Fox News this week. Did you guys catch this? Fox News mocked former Justice Stephen Breyer for writing the majority opinion in last week's landmark death penalty case, even though Breyer resigned from the court a month ago and isn't even sitting. Oh, wait. That didn't happen because Breyer is still there in his black robe. Plus, of course, we're going to have cocktail chatter. Emily, I appreciate your smile, your benevolent, indulgent smile.
I thought that was good. I was like totally with you. I was like, oh, yeah, I really was out of it last week. I missed so much news. And wow.
Emily does not have the accumulation of last week's show and the Stephen Breyer narrative in that as well. They're getting increasingly more Baroque.
Well, they have to because David has to keep it real. Also, David discovered that I, years ago, wrote a piece called Stop Telling Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Retire, which is like my most, what's that word, ignominious moment on the internet. Because I was trying to make the point that like a bunch of white men like bullying her, sort of berating her into retiring was not going to be effective. But it just says stop telling her to retire.
Sure.
And so it lives on forever. And my children particularly find it just so wrenching and awful that I wrote this piece.
There should be, but the thing is, the piece was, as I recall, fine. It's the headline. So there, we all, I think, in our past have been strangled by a headline.
I do not give the cop out for that because Emily wrote the piece so that it would have that particular headline.
Not true. And also, you can,
yes, she did.
You can strategically.
That story began with the headline.
I understand that, but willfully misinterpreting a headline after you've read the piece is not grounds for blaming her. It's just your choice to make the piece about something other than what the piece is about.
No, she wrote, she had a headline, which was Stop Telling Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Retire, parens, white men, because it will backfire. But the headline was just, that headline was deliberately provocative
right.
In order to, so that people would read it.
Right.
It was the 20% extra. Yeah. What I will say is, I'm pretty sure on the show, a number of times after that, I said that RBG absolutely should retire. Like, it was never that I thought she shouldn't retire. It was about the tactics. That's the only
right.
point.
But the point is, you're getting strangled by the headline for not, for people thinking that it's a piece that says something else.
Yeah, or at least, like, right, yes. I also said in the piece that it was a wee bit sexist that she was the center of this rather than Breyer at the time, since he's only a bit younger, and my children also think that is super irritating.
Well, also, he has outlived her.
Right, so. Exactly. In the end, like, at the time, I looked at the actuarial tables, and, you know, it was, like, pretty similar, because men die earlier, and that was my point, but reality did not bear up with my thesis particularly well. In any case,
that's not even a segment. Look at this, listeners. It's like your Slate Plus members, you didn't even have to join. You got a bonus segment. Yeah. All right, our first topic, is there an immigration crisis in the United States? There's been a rise in apprehensions on the southern border of the United States in the last few months, and there are now more than 15,000 unaccompanied migrant children in U.S. custody. Republicans are railing against the Biden administration for inviting migrants from Mexico and Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador to come to the U.S., even though the Biden administration has pretty clearly been saying, don't come now. Emily, is there a crisis, or is this just a seasonal fluctuation combined with the Biden administration trying to kind of make up for years of rather draconian and chaotic Trump southern border policies?
I mean, I think it's a crisis to have all these kids who, you know, are not with their parents, who need to have a good place to live. It is a seasonal fluctuation. There's also a good piece in Vox by Nicole Noria, my lovely former research assistant, who is doing such a good job covering this beat, pointing out that their hurricanes happened recently in Nicaragua and I think Guatemala and Honduras that have had a really bad effect on local economies, and that's also contributing probably to people coming. It makes sense that at the end of the Trump administration, even if it wasn't true that, you know, Biden was going to throw open the doors, that a lot of people who'd waited to come would start coming. It's also in line with the usual uptick in early spring, and also the pandemic is ebbing. So for a variety of reasons, we have thousands of kids to figure out what to do with, and this is a really hard problem. It's really hard.
Do you have any thoughts on what to do about it?
I mean, I definitely don't think that we should, like, you know, treat them poorly as a method of deterrence. Like, that's, I feel like the Trump administration did that. It was really bad. I guess, and I want them to be placed with families inside the United States. I think a lot of times parents send their kids with some destination in mind because they have relatives who are already here. But I think there is a real problem with encouraging this because it's dangerous. And I really worry about the well-being of these kids.
Well, so as I understand it, maybe I'm wrong about this, the reason there's this huge surge in unaccompanied children is that both the Trump administration and now the Biden administration have been very, very clear, like, families, you're not getting in. But the Biden administration has now said that children unaccompanied will be not immediately, like, thrown back from whence they came, or some, not even from whence they came, but will be taken care of. And therefore, there is a small incentive. And I think it's really gross for people to say, oh, this, you know, this means all these Central American parents, they, you know, they don't care. They're just going to send their kids. They don't even think about the well-being of the children. They just think America's going to take care of them. I mean, that's nonsense. But there is a small, like, sense, like, well, if your child is traveling alone, they may be treated more kindly and more welcomed into the United States than if we traveled as a family.
There's a specific thing that the Biden administration has done recently, which is part of the Public Health Service Act. The Trump administration said because of the pandemic meant you could keep out everybody, including kids. They had been allowing kids in, mishandling them, but not sending the kids to Mexico. Then the Biden administration lifted that Title 42 provision. So that is the most recent thing being done with respect to kids that creates this situation you're talking about, David. But I think their solution, one of their solutions is reinstating the Central American Minors Program, which is for those families you were talking about where you have somebody in the States who is legal. There is a process by which they can have their minors who are their minors brought into the United States through an incredibly rigorous process that was shut down under Trump, stranding 3,000 kids in the middle of it. And the reason that that might help a little bit is that it keeps those kids from making the march to the border. In other words, it basically sorts the paperwork before they travel so they know they have somewhere to go. But you do, I think it's the problem with the word crisis is that it's getting in the way of the Biden spin machine. But of course it's a crisis. Now, whether it's a crisis of Biden's making and how much he contributes to it, is important, of course, because it's politics, but it can be a crisis and not be Biden's fault. You know, it's,
right.
He has lifted some of the Trump administration, a lot of the Trump administration barriers, which has created, the Biden people will admit, some sort of a pull. It's very hard to send the message, don't come. Those Northern Triangle countries are in different states of difficulty. The Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And so that requires slow, patient foreign policy that the Trump administration basically either ignored or actively worked against. And then you have the seasonal issues. So you have a confluence of all of these things happening. And even the most acutely successful administration would take some period of time to get this thing worked through, because the solutions are short term in terms of the kids who are being held by Customs and Border Protection, which is really the kind of grittiest, worst housing as opposed to what Health and Human Services has. But then you have all these other long-term things. And the final point I would make is David Leonhardt made a good point this week about within Democratic politics, there's a question of whether is the position of the administration and the party that we, is it the old-fashioned position, which is strong on border, help undocumented immigrants in the United States? Or is there a new posture about what America's posture is towards people at the border? Is that shifting, and therefore the Democratic Party and the president doesn't have a clear position on that?
Yeah, I mean, to me, there's this, as somebody who's like really ambivalent about a lot of these issues, the thing that I find frustrating is the malframing or the failure to focus on immigration issues where the United States can do things that will be good and make obvious progress. I think the situation in the southern border and the migration, it's driven by economics, it's by climate, by weather, by violence, by drug trafficking, like this confluence of issues. And it's really hard to imagine it being fixed by anyone. But there are issues around like H-1B visas, around encouraging students to come to the U.S., around not persecuting green card holders, around not trying to make life difficult for someone who has a green card and wants to become a citizen, around making it easier to become a citizen. Those are issues that I would really love to see as much focus on as these issues. Now, obviously, there you can look at a bunch of them, and hopefully the Biden administration is looking at those as well. But just it's those are issues where it's clear, like there's, you know, the U.S. needs more skilled migrants who want to come here, and it needs to have families reunited, and not helping that out and not focusing on that is going to be bad in the long term.
The confluence of factors you cited for the cause of the push out of these countries is correct, but I disagree that there's nothing we can do about that. Like, there was a real disinvestment in giving aid to this part of Latin America during the Trump administration, which I think is really bad. And when you sort of move out globally, I mean, migration is going to be, like, it already is a huge issue, but it's only going to continue. I mean, the climate crisis, the changing weather patterns, there is going to be such a push out of the Southern Hemisphere if, you know, current climate trends continue. And we need some kind of global solution for asylum. And we have never had it. It's always been this total patchwork. Countries really don't adhere to international law in allowing for asylum. And usually what happens in a crisis is you have tons of people go to like a neighboring country that is less wealthy and stable. So, you know, Syrians moving into Turkey, or this Remain in Mexico policy that the Trump administration put in place put a lot of burden on Mexico to house all these people who are trying to get to the United States. And I, you know, we were just talking at a granular level about the U.S., and that makes sense. That's our focus. But it's really this, like, global set of factors that I think matters the most in figuring out how there could possibly be a better way.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I didn't mean to imply there was nothing to do to stabilize. I guess what I was trying to suggest is, like, there are things you can do to stabilize, but actually the global trends, like the large-scale trends, are very unfavorable and undesirable. If you think the climate situation is bad now, if you think the drought in Central America is bad now, wait 10 years.
Yeah.
It is a situation where we certainly should be doing all that we can to help people stay in the the countries and the communities where they live. But like, it's also naive to think that it's not going to be terrible. And there isn't, like, I don't think that the solution to the problems of migration in this hemisphere are everyone moves north to the United States and Canada. I just don't think it can work. It won't. The United States is not, like, the politics of this country are not going to accept that. But I just don't. But yet there's also the situation, which is that tens of millions of people are going to be at risk and immiserated. And so I don't know how those two things meet.
Well, when you talk about the politics, I think what one of the things that's a part of this is that we have to think through the amount of effort it would take for an administration to manage these sets of issues when they show up at the border, and to be more welcoming. An administration may be able to stake its capital on adjudicating these questions and making and aligning American policy with a more welcoming set of values. So, and that may be what everybody wants. The thing is, there are opportunity costs in time, attention, and political capital that affect an administration's policies and abilities in all these other areas where an administration tries to get work done. So it's not just yay or nay on specific policies. There's also a way in which immigration has really affected other kinds of policies administrations have tried to put forward by changing the political climate domestically in the states.
I mean, I will just say that I disagree with what you said earlier, David. Like, I think we could have tens of millions more people in this country in terms of the effect on the country. Like, I think it could, I buy into the kind of Matt Iglesias thesis. I buy into the economic research that suggests that, like, yes, there are costs sometimes locally and costs to particular people. And I see that. And I think we should address that. Like, other low wage workers, often people who recently immigrated are the people who get pushed out of the labor force or lose some jobs to the people who got here last. I see that problem, but I also see the research that shows tremendous economic potential. I think you were making a different point, which is about the political viability of waste.
Yes, I 100% agree. I agree with Matt Iglesias. This could be a country of a billion people. Yes.
Okay. Right. Yes. Anyway, just clarifying, not really even disagreeing.
Aren't they connected? Which is to say, the world that you want and that you're talking about, Emily, has to jump over the barriers that David's talking about.
Totally. I'm not sure that's possible because I think a lot of times, like, we all as immigrants or children of immigrants, like, we get here and we change our feelings about, like, pulling up the drawbridge, right? It's not obvious that just because you got here a generation or two ago, you're really excited about everyone else coming.
I also think that we're in the world that we're heading into in terms of the climate. I'm reading this really grim climate book, which is maybe making me more apocalyptic than I would. It's just going to make...
Which book?
Ministry for the Future, Kim Stanley Robinson. It's a novel. It's actually not that. It's less grim. It's more hopeful, but it's still pretty grim. It makes me just think, like, the politics are going to get more exclusionary and more nationalistic and more violent in opposition to those others who seek to kind of take our space. Emily, can I take us back to sort of a more tactical and quotidian question, which is that one of the reasons that President Trump was able to carry out such brutal and in some ways extremely effective policies on immigration, restricting immigration, treating people at the border so brutally, was that the courts gave him a huge latitude. Like, the courts basically, there were, you know, moments of restraint by courts here and there, but there was no massive legal crackdown. And because also Trump knew that Congress would not be able to act. Like, the courts are always like, well, if Congress wants to do this, they can legislatively change this, but otherwise we give the president a wide berth when it comes to matters of immigration and the border. Do you think that same thing will hold true for President Biden? Is there a Biden equivalent where Biden can do extremely expansive things around immigration as an executive and the courts will give him latitude, saying that, oh, if Congress wants to stop him, they can stop him?
Well, I mean, the courts already said no to his 100-day pause on deportations. You know, generally in immigration law, when you're talking about, like, individual case adjudication, people just have almost no rights. Like, immigration law is, like, a place in which, like, there's almost no constitutional principle. Like, so there is so little due process. It's, like, really bleak for lawyers who are litigating this. And there is this important rule that the Trump administration put in place that the Biden people have not revoked or rescinded that continues to just give enormous discretion to the president, to the executive, in a way that allows people to be excluded. So I think there are some really interesting questions to watch about how much the Biden administration is going to sort of self-restrain. And I don't quite know what will happen, but the courts have been very willing to go along with immigration restrictive policies from the president.
What I wonder is what is the ultimate value at the center of the Biden administration or politics or American politics in general? So everything now is happening in the wake of correcting the Trump administration's policies, whether it's, you know, sending all migrants into Mexico to live for 2 years in awful conditions, whether it's dropping all the foreign policy that was in place to do the careful, slow spade work in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, or whether it's changing the Central American Miners Program. All of that is corrective and repairing. It happens in the context of the Trump administration. But then what is the ultimate Biden? So do people think it's a part of an American value to have lots of inflows, either for economic reasons or moral reasons? And who determines what that is? You know, reunifying families to fix the Trump administration is different than are we a country that welcomes families and how many and for what reason? And it feels like that doesn't get figured out until... I mean, that's going to be very hard to figure out in and of in itself, but also it's hard to figure out while you're trying to do all these, repair efforts from the Trump years.
Slate Plus members, you get bonus segments on the Gabfest, also other benefits, zero ads on any Slate podcast, bonus episodes of certain other shows, and you're supporting the work that we do here on the Gabfest and the work that's being done at Slate. It's only $1 for your first month, so go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to sign up. Super excited about our Slate Plus topic this week. It's going to be a really great discussion, I hope. I'm anticipating a great discussion about a sports conundrum that Emily and her family faces regarding the rules of basketball and the rules of refereeing and how it impacted a school in New Haven, Connecticut. So go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to hear that excellent discussion today.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Two Democratic senators, Tammy Duckworth of Illinois and Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, told the White House on Tuesday they would vote against all of President Biden's non-diversity appointees, that is, those who aren't racial minorities or LGBTQ, until the White House appointed another Asian American or Pacific Islander person to a prominent position or made some sort of commitment for doing that down the road. They threatened that, then they pulled that back. But that was in part a response to some of the real anger, fear, and frustration in Asian American communities following the Atlanta murder spree that killed six people of Asian descent among its eight victims. There are also reports that suggest a huge upsurge in harassment and attacks of Asian Americans in the last year. We're joined by Claire Jean Kim, who's a professor of political science and Asian American studies at UC Irvine. She's working on a book, Asian Americans in an Anti-Black World, which is a great title. I love that title. Claire Jean Smith, welcome to the Gabfest. Can you start by talking about this idea of racial triangulation and how it is important to understand what's happening with racial and class conflict in America?
Hi, David. Thanks for having me. So you're asking me about the racial triangulation idea, and that's a theory that I advanced in a 1999 article by that name. And in that article, I was really trying to say, when we look at how Asian Americans are racialized and positioned in U.S. society, it's different than how Black people are racialized and positioned. So how do we think through that difference? And I tried to postulate that, you know, Asian Americans are triangulated vis-a-vis Blacks and whites, seen as more foreign, but also superior to Black people. So there are different axes for assessing these different groups. I've actually moved away from that theory. It seems to be taken up by some people right now, but I am moving away from that for my book, Asian Americans in an Anti-Black World, which I'm finishing up right now.
And you're moving away from it and toward what exactly? That makes me curious.
What I'm moving toward is I'm trying to theorize again, where are Asians positioned in U.S. society? And the theory is that most of Asian American studies as a field has focused on white supremacy and how white people push down Asian Americans or persecute them through various kinds of laws. And what I'm interested in is looking at how the racial order is structured in addition by anti-Blackness. So what happens when we think about white supremacy as pushing all non-white groups down, but anti-Blackness as lifting up all not Black groups? And that would mean Asian Americans are sort of pushed down by white supremacy, but also elevated by anti-Blackness, elevated over Black people. So that leads me to theorizing that Asian Americans have something, a property called not Blackness, that advantages them, that is sort of like you could think of it as a structural advantage relative to Black people, even as at the same time they have not whiteness, which is a structural disadvantage relative to whites.
Which makes it, it would seem to me, a highly complex and moving picture to try to look at this, because you're talking about two different groups as those two are changing in real time.
Exactly. It's a fluid, dynamic picture. And one of the reasons that I think this theory makes a difference, like what difference does it make how we see how Asians are positioned, is my argument is because of their not Blackness, which is attributed to them from the beginning, from the time the first Chinese come on shore in California around the Gold Rush. You know, if we think about anti-Blackness as a structural feature of U.S. society and think about the society wanting to reproduce that sort of anti-Blackness, what happens is Asian Americans are lifted up periodically. There are certain openings historically where Asian Americans are lifted up because that helps the broader society keep Black people in their place. It might be defending Jim Crow during the Cold War. And then there are other examples after that. But my point being that Asian Americans have this fluidity because that helps to sort of nail down structural anti-Blackness. So there's a great fluidity and sort of movement around where these groups are, except for Black people who are always on the bottom and except for white people who are always on the top.
Do you think, Claire, I remember there was a professor at my college who I think wrote a book called How the Irish Became White, which in a class I did not take. But this idea that there are certain groups, and I seem to remember it being Italian and Irish immigrants who are allowed to become white after not being perceived as white. And as a Jew, I feel like a lot of Jews have sort of made them, like they've strongly identified with their Americanness a generation ago in an effort to be seen as more white. Are Asian Americans, do you think, headed towards a path where Asian Americans become white, or no? You think they remain as a distinct group?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, Asian Americanists, you know, people who study Asian Americans are very divided on this. There are some people who argue if we look at things like certain kind of gross statistics like intermarriage rates or education rates or residential segregation rates, that we see Asian Americans assimilating more and more with whites. So it looks as though they're going to follow that Jewish pattern. At the same time, I think there's a difference, and that one of the differences is phenotypical, right? To the degree that Asian Americans are always distinguishable in some sense, and of course this would diminish with intermarriage, but to the degree they remain distinguishable through language, through appearance, through names, I think that doesn't happen. And one of the points of my book is that having Asian Americans as a minority group that supposedly makes it on its own, as opposed to being structurally advantaged, which is what I argue, to have a minority group that you can say makes it on its own is an incredibly powerful ideological political tool. So there's a sort of functionality for Asian Americans that, you know, in being another minority that you can juxtapose to the bad minority, the failed minority that is Black people.
One of the things I'm struck by in your work, and also in some of the reporting about the terrible shootings in Atlanta, is the the heterogeneity of the Asian American community. I mean, this is like the whole idea of a category of Asian American lumps together people from these different countries. And there's a lot of economic diversity and range. It's not true that you only have well-off people. And in the Atlanta shootings, there is are these very wealthy spa owners. One of them was a big Republican donor trying to be, you know, somebody in Republican politics in Georgia. And then you see these spa workers who are at the lower opposite end of the economic spectrum. And I wonder how you think that complicates the kind of politics of Asian American identity and the place of Asian Americans in, you know, in American politics.
It absolutely does. And I would say that, you know, Asian Americans, all racialized groups are quite diverse, of course, but Asian Americans perhaps the most so, with so many dozens of different national origins and languages represented. So it's a central theme in Asian American studies to question always what, you know, to pose the question you just did, which is, does it make sense to talk about all of the groups under this under a single rubric? Does it make sense to say that people are Asian American as opposed to Chinese American, Japanese American? And it does complicate any attempt to sort of argue where Asians are positioned relative to other groups. But at the same time, in my book, I really want to argue that all Asian Americans, even the most disadvantaged ones, have a certain kind of property of not blackness. And that allows them to maneuver in U.S. society in ways that black people cannot. So, for example, when we hear from Asian Americans today, we are afraid, we are not seen as real Americans. You know, we're afraid to go out of the house, we feel shunned. These are things that black people can relate to all the time, right? Not just during COVID, not just during a national crisis, but all the time. So, again, I think even with that incredible diversity, by being Asian, by being seen as Asian as opposed to black, there is a certain kind of advantage that comes with that. And just to give you a very quick example, they're not Asian Americans. We are not policed in the same way that black people are. We are not seen as a physical threat most of the time. I understand this has shifted a little during COVID, but this is temporary and will revert back to the norm, which is sort of a suppressed hostility toward Asian Americans right below the surface.
So, Claire, I was wondering about what you think accounts for the most recent attacks, and particularly those against septuagenarians.
Right. You know, it's not clear in some of these cases, for example, some of the attacks in San Francisco, whether they were robberies or, you know, that had a racial angle to them or whether they were simply racial incidents. So I think the point is that people who are lashing out against Asian Americans right now are choosing vulnerable targets, right? So the elderly are vulnerable. Most of the targets are women, and often the targets are economically dispossessed or marginal communities. So I think there's a tendency to target people who can't fight back and with whom there's the least cost in attacking them.
Just going back to your response a minute ago about that you sense that this would be a temporary moment of, I don't know, the moment where Asian Americans are being targeted or being victimized. Why do you think it's temporary? And what would cause this cycle to change?
I think it's temporary, but then it will recur. So I should clarify that. Because if we look back at the historical pattern of anti-Asian violence and harassment, et cetera, we see major crests or waves of it, and then it subsides, and then it comes again. And what happens to bring it out again, I said that there's sort of this suppressed hostility and resentment toward Asian Americans, I think, below the surface for a lot of white Americans particularly. And then certain events bring it out. So, for example, in the 1870s in California, there was a regional depression or economic contraction that brought out resentment toward Chinese workers, which led to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. In the 1940s, it was the war with Japan and the bombing of Pearl Harbor brought out those emotions, and then, you know, which led to the internment of Japanese Americans. Now, the Japanese Americans had been persecuted in the decades leading up to Pearl Harbor, but they hadn't been interned, right? That drastic step of interning them came after Pearl Harbor. In the 1980s, it was trade tensions between the U.S. and Japan that led to the murder of Vincent Chin in 1982 in Detroit, which led to sort of an increase in Asian American activism. And then now, with COVID-19 being a global pandemic, we're seeing the rise, you know, the upsurge in anti-Asian sentiment and action again. So it's there always sort of baked into American culture, I think, but it comes out, you know, at certain moments. And I think one of the reasons this moment is so shocking for Asian Americans is this is probably the most dramatic anti-Asian hate and violence we've seen since, I think, the 1940s. So almost a century. And I think, Asian Americans in the time since the 1940s have been invited to assimilate and integrate to a much greater degree than they were before the 1940s. And I think Asian Americans feel particularly disappointed and hurt and distressed that after all of these decades of sort of integrating and becoming, you know, moving into white neighborhoods, moving into white workplaces, intermarrying, et cetera, that there is still this sort of undercurrent of hostility that comes out under certain circumstances.
Can I just jump on the piggyback on that quickly, which is American politicians have always bashed China when it's useful, both parties. That seems like it's going to continue as a political matter, having the big threat from China, both real and perceived, in a geopolitical sense, is the backbone of a lot of arguments. How do you think that plays in this post-COVID-19 period where, you know, if the pandemic isn't a threat, the rhetoric nevertheless continues because of China's role in the economy and on the global stage?
I think that's a very important part of the picture. So I do think that U.S.-China tensions will be ongoing and will be sort of a dominant feature of the political landscape. I think that within that scenario, there will be particular moments where the U.S. and China have conflicts, whether it be minor military skirmishes or something else, or trade, you know, conflicts, which could produce more spikes in anti-Asian violence here. There's also conflict with North Korea, right? That's also another source of potential trigger for anti-Asian violence in the U.S. But I wanted to also mention in relation to COVID that the violence against Asian Americans that we're seeing is a really interesting contrast to what we're seeing with Black Americans. So Black Americans are not being targeted at, you know, in the way Asian Americans are. But if we look at the American Public Media's report, The Color of Coronavirus, it's Black and Indigenous people in particular who have been impacted in terms of mortality rates with COVID. And so that really forces us to look at what is, how do we think about racial violence in a way that goes beyond attacks, right? Verbal harassment, pushing people down. How do we look at how racial violence is built into our social structure? So how is the, you know, particular, to choose Black Americans for a moment, their prior health status, their segregation, their exposure to various environmental toxins, their entanglement in carceral spaces, all of these things make Black Americans have higher mortality rates with COVID. So how is racial violence actually a structural feature of American society so that we don't just focus on, you know, the overt sort of racial attacks, what we call hate crimes, for lack of a better phrase, that we're seeing with Asian Americans now.
Claire Jean Kim, professor of political science and Asian American studies at UC Irvine. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America is a new book by the great Baltimore journalist Alec McGillis. It's about Amazon, but appropriately, it's also about the whole nation, since Amazon is in some sense trying to be the whole nation, the whole world. And it's about the vast rise in Amazon and the few winners and ton of losers and many in kind of in between as Amazon and the Amazonian way inexorably changes communities around the U.S. It's a human story of the costs borne by actual people, actual Americans in most cases, as this the way we shop, the way we live, the way we work has changed. So, Alec, Fulfillment is, I would hazard to say, an ironic title, since there are so many more losers than winners in what you're talking about. But just tell us what the basic thesis of this book is.
Sure. The basic thesis is that we have this extraordinary regional disparities in this country that are actually what I set out to write about in the first place. I've been wanting for a long time to write about these disparities because I would see them as I would travel the country as a reporter. I'd go out to the Midwest during the Great Recession, the early Obama years, and to see how much a lot of these places were struggling. And then I'd come back to Washington, where I was working at the Washington Post at the time, and just be struck by this extraordinary prosperity, extraordinary disconnect between what was going on there and the rest of the country. And I saw the gap also between here in Baltimore, where I now live again, and Washington, just 40 miles down the road, just enormous gaps that have been growing wider and wider. And I want to write about those gaps. And I actually settled on Amazon as the frame for that story for two reasons. One is that Amazon is now so ubiquitous in the country that it's just a really handy way to take you around the country and what we're becoming as a country, because they're just kind of everywhere and permeating our whole life. But it's also a good frame for the story because Amazon is itself contributing to the problem of regional disparities and regional inequality. One reason we have such concentration of wealth in certain places, certain cities, is that we have such concentration in our economy in certain companies in certain sectors, not just Amazon, but the other tech giants as well. But I chose to tell the story through Amazon because, again, it has such a physical manifestation around the country that it's just a very good way at looking who we are.
So one of the things I felt reading your book, I mean, you're really writing about inequality in this wide-ranging, deep way, and I felt very implicated in it because I am definitely someone who shops a lot online. I don't like going shopping. I find it to be a big waste of time, but I also really don't like seeing parts of cities that have stores in them being depleted and boarded up. Like, I've found that to be a really depressing phenomenon since my childhood in Philadelphia. I don't know what to do about this. It just feels like the benefits of Amazon and companies like it for consumers are really significant and real. And yet the effects on employees and on cities and, the urban landscape are terrible.
Yes. Well, you are my ideal reader. Yeah. because the book is really, above all, is sort of meant for readers like you to reckon with all of this and with what's behind, that easy one click. And that easy one click has, of course, grown so much more appealing this past year and so much more prevalent. I'm not an absolutist about this. I'm not out there urging a boycott or anything. And I use Amazon when I have to, as sort of a last resort. But I do think it's really important that, especially coming out of this past year, that we all sort of try our best to re-engage with the worlds around us, the towns and cities around us, the communities around us, the businesses around us, the physical world around us, not just in terms of our shopping, but also, entertainment, the theater, all these places that are just really reeling after this year and that we're going to lose if we don't re-engage with them. And there are definitely also, structural things that we can do politically to address the problems that the book describes, notably stronger antitrust, but at the personal level, I do think we have agency, and I do think it's important for us to think about what lies behind the click and try as best we can to seek other options. I mean, there are, of course, other ways to do e-commerce shopping, one-click shopping without going through the giant, but that the physical world really does matter, and we'd be so much the poorer as you describe, without it. So, especially after this year, my gosh, this year the numbers have gone through the roof. They've gotten so much bigger, and that was all our doing. We were all kind of implicated in that.
Alec, can you talk a little bit about how much bigger it got this year, not just in numbers, but also in habits. I mean, it feels like we all kind of got tattooed with this. And then kind of connected to that is Amazon's also expanding like into the healthcare area, which feels like would be even more encroaching on our lives.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, before this past year, a lot of people, a lot of sort of, you know, liberal-minded Americans who liked Amazon for the convenience still felt some compunction about using it. But it was as if this past year there was this massive permission given, this massive from the authorities, you know, from the public health overlords to just go that route whole hog, and people just did with such alacrity, and so you have, you know, sales up 40% year over year, 400,000 more workers hired, 50% more warehouse space. I mean, you see it just viscerally. You see it, you know, if you're walking through down your streets or your back alley, you see the boxes piled up on recycling day. You see the constant trucks making the vans making the delivery. I mean, the very moment that I clicked to send my book into my publisher, a van pulled up outside, you know, the neighbor's house, right in view of my window. I mean, just, it's constant. The highways just filled. Last Friday, I was taking my younger son to a baseball tournament 20 miles up I-95, and I swear there were 20 Amazon trucks just in that short 20-mile stretch. It was really kind of eerie. So, it's just, again, I think we're not really reckoning with just how much larger it got this past year, partly because we all feel kind of complicit in it and we don't really want to talk about it. And it'll be really interesting to see how much those habits stick with us or if we fall back somewhat.
Alec, one of the things that I think is really confusing in a good way about your work is that the winning and losing you describe tracks sort of with politics. It tracks a lot with geography and tracks sort of with politics in the sense that there are more of these winners. If you look at who Amazon employees, every Amazon employee I've ever met, at least, is a Democrat. Losers are, in this case, are often in red, rural, exurban areas. And we have now this interesting unionization fight in Bessemer, Alabama, a red state, as red a state as it can be, but there's a fight to unionize an Amazon warehouse down there.
Led by a lot of black people, we should say, who are probably Democrats.
Probably Democrats, yeah. But what I'm wondering about, and the issues which would change kind of how Amazon behaves, or tend to be issues that Democrats traditionally would be aligned with and Republicans would be opposed, because Republicans generally want big companies to be free to do what they want to their workers and to the environment around them. Is a political solution to any of what you're talking about possible because of these sort of cross-cutting things? Or is the sort of poisonous partisanship that exists preventing anything from happening in that way?
That's a very good question. The politics of this are really interesting and actually quite different, I think, than on a lot of other issues. And it's why I'm actually kind of hopeful that something could happen. What's interesting about Amazon is that while it's universal and it's obviously in its appeal to the consumer, it's everywhere, it is especially strong as a company in blue, you know, with these sort of upper middle class, highly educated, big metro consumer. There's a reason why you see all those pictures of Amazon boxes piled up outside New York apartment buildings and in lobbies, you know, these sea of boxes that the poor doorman doesn't even know what to do with. So, and whereas Walmart still is somewhat stronger in sort of more rural, you know, white working class, more conservative areas around the country, Amazon is strongest, and also strongest in its political appeal. There was a poll showing that Amazon, you know, is the most trusted institution among Democrats just a year or two ago, ahead of the press, ahead of colleges, ahead of government. And then, as you said, a lot of the Amazon workers, the rank and file workers and drivers, are also Democrats by virtue of being, you know, in many cases, you know, working class, black and Hispanic urban residents. So what you have in a way is what I think of now as the Amazon coalition, that Democrats have become a coalition of Amazon consumers, upper, you know, income, highly educated, metro, mostly white consumers, and then the mostly black and Hispanic voters who pack and deliver things to them. That's definitely an awkward coalition and a tricky one to hold together over time, because you might actually see some of those workers become less comfortable in sort of remaining in this sort of alliance with the very people that who are sort of blithely taking their ordering things from them and not even opening the door when the box arrives. And you actually saw last fall a bit of a shift, right, among some Hispanic voters and a smaller number of Black male voters over to Trump. Meanwhile, you have this Democratic Party that likes Amazon, generally as consumers, is very aligned with tech, at the sort of elite level. You have big tech has always had, you know, Democratic alignment with lots of revolving door people going from the Obama administration to tech. Big tech's money has gone mostly to the Democrats in recent years. That's the natural political alliance. But then you have, voices on the left now, including Elizabeth Warren and Lina Khan, who wrote the great Yale Law piece a couple years ago about antitrust and Amazon. And so you have this real battle emerging within the left, within the Democrats, over what to do about the giants and whether the Democrats need to rethink their sort of natural tendency to be cozy with big tech as the Obama administration was. So will the Biden administration split from the Obama administration's lax approach to antitrust is a really, really interesting question. And then meanwhile, on the other side, the Republicans are actually on this issue showing some potential for consensus, that they have their own reasons for being wary of big tech, which have a lot to do with their constantly feeling sort of discriminated against by Google and Facebook, and also still resentful of Jeff Bezos for owning the Amazon Washington Post. And so they're coming from their own place on this, but there's a genuine distrust and wariness of big tech on the right as well, and which is sort of a new thing for, as you said, for Republicans who are generally kind of okay with the big corporation. You might actually see some potential here for some kind of action across the board. It's going to be really fascinating to watch.
That is a good segue for the question I wanted to ask you. So I was reading an article in the New York Times this morning about the union drive in Bessemer, Alabama, and what's at stake. And there's a quote from a comms person from Amazon who says, "As it relates to progressive Democrats in general, we've been surprised by some of the negative things we've seen certain members say in the press and on social media. If there is a progressive company in this country, it's Amazon. Find me another large company paying 2 times the minimum wage, providing great health benefits from day one, 95% education reimbursement, safe working environment, and so on. We really think we are an example of what a U.S. company should be doing for its employees." I was wondering what you thought about that. It seemed at odds with some of the stories we've heard about working conditions at Amazon, for sure. And also, this idea of undercutting this union drive is itself, the tactics of the companies have been so aggressive. And I wonder what you think, as you've been following that, how much is at stake?
Oh, so much is at stake. I mean, I think of it really in kind of grand historical terms, you know, going back to the book, really the core chapter of the book, the heart of the book is about the transformation of work, of what work means in America, as sort of told through this place called Sparrows Point outside Baltimore that was home to the biggest steel mill in the world in the 1950s, 30,000 people working there. And it has been wiped off the face of the map and has now been replaced by warehouses, including two Amazon warehouses. And people went from making $35 or more an hour there to now making $15 an hour. They had union voice there. Now, of course, they don't. The work now is not nearly as dangerous as it was at the steel mill, but it's still incredibly physically taxing, incredibly strenuous, and much more sort of kind of atomized and isolating, and less lacking in purpose and meaning. But they got the better pay at those steel jobs because they organized in the 30s and 40s and 50s last century. Things were much worse before they did that at those mills. And so I really see the question now is whether jobs at the warehouses, which really have become like the new mass employment places of our time, you know, with hundreds of thousands more people hired just last year, that's sort of where you go to work right now if you don't really have any other clear option and you just need a job. And those jobs can be lifted up in a way that those mill jobs were across the country, that would be a really big deal. Not, you know, higher pay, yes. I think Amazon can pay more when Jeff Bezos is netting, you know, $60 billion a year just last year, and his, you know, his net worth grew $60 billion in 1 year. They did manage to pay a couple dollars more early in the pandemic, then they took that away. But it's not just about the pay. It's also about voice workers having more say in the way the work is done in these incredibly high-pressure warehouses. There's a reason turnover is so high. If the jobs were so great, people would be staying longer. So the stakes really are just enormous.
You know, sometimes companies try to get ahead of antitrust actions by the government by trying to fix or address some of these problems. Do you see anything Amazon could actually do rather than what they may be trying to do as a kind of PR move?
As far as Amazon being able to head some antitrust action off, the one possibility I've seen floated in it, you know, in the business press, is the notion that they could somehow just go ahead right now and split off AWS, which is their hugely profitable cloud arm, Amazon Web Services, which they opened up in 2006, and it's just been a massively profitable thing for them to, that it's basically allowed them, the problem is that it's been so profitable that it has allowed them both to kind of collect data that helps on the retail side, but more importantly, is allowing them to essentially kind of subsidize the retail operation. One reason they've been able to wipe out their competition on the retail side is they can kind of take the profits from the cloud side and move them over that way. That's one thing that's discussed is breaking that off, and you could see them possibly doing that on their own. Beyond that, that would be a very big move. But beyond that, all the actions that are being contemplated are so thoroughgoing and deep, such as, you know, breaking off the other, you know, big issue is that you have the platform of the retail website and them selling on their own platform against other competitors. And that is really kind of the heart of the matter. And it's hard to see how they could sort of on their own try to address that to stave off action, because it's such a deep thicket, and it's also interwoven, and it's also just been so profitable for them to have that kind of that platform control.
And then secondly, on the Republican point, the opposition to big tech seems motivated, animated, maybe wholly or maybe just in part by the kind of anti-cancel culture, which makes me wonder how interested they are in a lot of what you write about. Or is it really they don't like Amazon because it's the Washington Post, and they don't like big tech because they think it's stifling their voices, even though that's an open question. And that's the aim, that they're not so much concerned about the workers and the economic conditions you're writing about.
It's always hard to gauge, you know, how much, you know, a Josh Hawley's or some other Republicans or Marco Rubio's concerns are, you know, or how genuine their move towards sort of a more kind of populist, worker-centered outlook is. But I do think that smart Republicans are aware that there is a realignment underway right now in our politics. We just have, and Democrats don't like to talk about this very much, but the Democratic Party is becoming more and more dominated by highly educated, upper-income voters, you know, as more and more sort of suburban Romney Republicans have kind of moved over to the party. And so you could see, you really could see some Republicans opportunistically reaching out, you know, taking action on this front with the aim of actually helping their party's chances. I mean, it's worth noting that the union, there's a really interesting story about the union that's doing the best more organizing in the Times, yes, on Wednesday. And it's talked about the fact that the union is actually politically somewhat idiosyncratic. It's very kind of faith-based union, and one of the leaders actually said that of the Mid-South chapter said that he wagered that a lot of their members have actually voted for Trump. So things are actually, you know, as we saw last fall, things are actually somewhat fluid at the sort of lower ends of the income spectrum politically right now. And so you can see some Republicans trying to make a move on that.
Alec McGillis's book is Fulfillment, Winning, and Losing in One-Click America. You could buy it on Amazon. You could buy it somewhere else, too. But don't. Probably don't.
Go to Indie Books or somewhere else.
I'm just saying, I Googled it just to see, does it show up on Amazon, has Amazon blacklisted it, and Amazon is glad to sell it.
That would be really good for Alex book
sales.
Yeah,
I'm sure he would. You desperate, desperate for Amazon to crack you.
The strange thing is I ordered it from them in February just as a test, and it still hasn't arrived. I got a note a couple weeks ago saying it would be delayed. There's something very strange going on with my order.
Maybe it's, so it's over, maybe it's sold and they're out of stock.
It's that we can only hope. Yes. They need to get more of it.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Let us go to cocktail chatter. When you are sitting in contemplation, I don't know if you can order cocktails on Amazon. I'm not sure you can. I don't know if Amazon sells alcohol. I hope not. But you're having chatter and you're talking with your dear ones. Emily Bazelon, what are you going to be chattering about?
So I had an amazing reporting trip to New Orleans last week and this week, and I just want to tease this story that I'm going to be writing about in the months to come. I got to see the exoneration and release from prison of a man named Utico Briley, who was convicted of an armed robbery when he was 19, 8 years ago, and given a 60-year sentence, even though no one was injured in this robbery. And through his own sort of sheer force of will and the efforts of my sister, Laura Bazelon, who was his amazingly fierce advocate as his lawyer, and then the voters of Louisiana.
I think, GabFest listeners, would you want to get on the wrong side of a Bazelon lawyer? I don't think so.
Exactly. Not my sister. You would not. Anyway, Utico Briley was released from prison last Friday. And I mentioned the voters of Louisiana, as well as Utico himself and Laura, his lawyer, because the voters of Louisiana elected a new district attorney in the winter, Jason Williams, and a couple of new judges to the bench, including Judge Angel Harris. And what happened with Utico's case was all about the way those new officials approached their jobs. The district attorney agreed that Utico Briley was innocent, and the judge signed the order. And it was really a very moving experience to watch. I've never been a reporter in that situation, and I will remember it forever. So anyway, that's my chatter.
John, what is your chatter?
What a great story. I mean, for all the obvious reasons, but also like a great family story.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful.
I think of all those poor prosecutors, like just being like me when I realized that I'm arguing with Emily about something I don't understand. And I feel what those poor prosecutors must have felt like. No wonder they capitulated.
Or Laura, more like.
So I, too, was off reporting on something that's coming later, but that's part of what is making me think about this. Andrew Atkinson, who's a economics professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, did an analysis for that was a part of a Brookings Institution conference last week about the COVID-19 fatalities. And basically, the analysis showed that the fatalities could have stayed under 300,000 versus the death toll, which is on its way to 600,000 and maybe at the high end of 600,000. And basically, the argument is that if the country had just adopted widespread masks wearing, social distancing, and testing, that the deaths would have been under 300,000. And the figuring out of what happened beyond President Trump, who was actively working against those two, which is amazing when you think about it. So three things are identified, and he actively worked against testing because he didn't want the numbers to go up, and he actively undermined the masking. So he's obviously culpable in an extraordinary way, but there are also other complex reasons that we failed so badly as a country. I think this study is fascinating, but I think more important is that there's a kind of danger to only blaming President Trump, and it'll be really fascinating to see how and if we think about the bigger, larger forces that caused the public health failure. And the other thing, speaking of presidents, is that my paperback came out this week with an epilogue about that was written after the election. So if you haven't bought the book already, you now have an opportunity.
You're talking about COVID reminded me I wanted to plug your excellent 60 Minutes piece about the Marietta schools. So interesting, like to watch the superintendent talk about how evidence-based he was, and then there are all these kids in a gym playing sports with no masks. It was
Thank you.
Really well done. So everyone should go watch that.
And then to watch him do what nobody ever does, which is basically wrestle with that contradiction, like live and on television.
Squirm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but and he obviously is, you know, as he said, he is really conflicted about that whole thing. But I talked, it didn't get into the piece, but I talked with one of those seniors he was talking about, just serendipitously ran into him in the weight room, who is getting a free ride somewhere because of the final, you know, and it's his senior year, which is one of the things that Grant Rivera was talking about, by allowing sports for those kids for whom it is a pathway to a better life. But thank you. I'm the whole team that worked on it are really amazing, and it was a meaningful piece.
All right, my chatter. I've done a last minute chatter change because I'd forgotten the best thing I saw this week, which is a post from Janelle Shane. Janelle Shane is an AI researcher who is so conscious of the when AI goes wrong. She collects examples of AI going wrong. And so this is a piece which collects the efforts at pickup lines that these AI algorithms came up with, and they're just so good. So I'm going to read some. So this is one from an AI called Da Vinci. I'm losing my voice from all the screaming your hotness is causing me to do. You have the most beautiful fangs I've ever seen. I have exactly 4 stickers. I need you to be the 5th. I will briefly summarize the plot of Back to the Future 2 for you. I once worked with a guy that looked just like you. He was a normal human with a family. Are you a normal human with a family? You look like Jesus if he were a butler in a Russian mansion. This is one called Curie. Your eyes are like 2 rainbows and a rainbow of eyes. I can't help but stare. Picked up some pretty flowers. Want to smell them? Here, try to take my hand off. Hey, my name is John Smith. Will you sit on my bread box while I cook? Is there some kind of speed limit on that thing? I love AI so much.
They're so dada.
But pretty soon they'll be so good. One of my all-time favorite things on the internet is this video, which I've talked about on the GabFest probably 12 times, of a robot flipping pancakes. And it's a robot learning how to flip pancakes. And at the beginning, it's so bad. And it's so bad you laugh every time it does it because the pancake goes off, you know, like 30 feet away. And then within like 5 minutes, the robot has completely mastered a pancake flip, which I, a 50-year-old person who's been making pancakes all my life, cannot do. And I was like so happy to laugh at that AI, that robot. And then it just like clearly coming to dominate. So I'm going to be at a bar sometime in the future trying to pick somebody up. And
tell them their fangs are lovely. It will always work.
Some robot's going to come along and just like have a great line, have a devastatingly good line. Listeners, you have also sent us wonderful chatters this week. Please keep them coming. Tweet them to us at Slate GabFest. And our chatter this week is from Matthew Dix. And it's an article by Philip Hoare for The Guardian. Sperm whales in the 19th century shared ship attack information.
It's this fascinating story about how analyzing whalers' logbooks demonstrate that whales, sperm whales particularly, during this time in history when they were being hunted, quickly changed their tactics in terms of dealing with predators in order to survive. The original predator of the sperm whale was the orca whale. It was the only sort of threat in the ocean. And what sperm whales did in order to protect themselves is they formed groups. They encircled themselves into this pod to protect themselves from the orca whales. But this proved to be terrible in terms of defending yourself against whalers, because it just allowed these whalers to kill many whales at once. And so over a very short period of time, studying these logbooks of these whalers, they discovered this sort of shift in culture, this change in tactic, where rather than grouping up, when whalers attacked, sperm whales separated and they would swim upwind so that the ship couldn't chase them because they were all wind-powered ships. It's amazing. It's this idea that this isn't the effect of anything related to, you know, a biological change in these animals over time. It is just culture. It is probably communication is what they are guessing resulted in allowing sperm whales to survive. They're the mammal with the largest brain on the planet, so I guess it's not so surprising. So once again, sperm whales in the 19th century shared ship attack information. It was in The Guardian.
So great.
That was awesome.
Great.
That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Audio. June Thomas is managing producer. And Alicia Montgomery is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Please follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet your chatter to us there. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson and David Plotz, thank you for listening. We will talk to you next week, which is April. Happy April. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? We had a Slate Plus topic all teed up, and then I saw a tweet from Emily on Thursday morning, and now Emily's going to bring some sports to Slate Plus. Emily,
watch
can you tell
out.
Us what's going on?
Normally, me talking about sports is a terrible idea, but in this case, I think I know what happened. So my son Simon is on a high school basketball team at Wilbercross High School in New Haven. I'm just going to preface this by saying that they wore masks through the entire season and there were very strict rules on spectating. Almost nobody allowed in the gym. Okay. So Simon's team, which is a really excellent basketball team, of which Simon, I will say, is a minor contributor, was in the semifinals of, like, this year's league championships on the other night. And I was very sadly at the airport watching on FaceTime, and in the last, like, 30 seconds of the game, Simon's team scored 3 points, went up by three, and it was the end of the game. The buzzer sounded. My husband was like, they won! The kids all went onto the floor. And then the refs called the game back saying that there were actually 0.3 seconds left on the clock. They restarted the game with 0.3 seconds. The other team, West Haven, passed the ball in and one of their players took a 3-point shot and was fouled by our team, got 3 foul shots, went to the line, and sunk all the baskets. So then the game went into overtime, and then our team lost in overtime. So this seemed like this crazy set of events, and it turns out that there is a rule, and I'm sure basketball fans have already figured this out, that you are not allowed to shoot from the field with only 0.3 seconds or less left on the clock. The only way you can score at that point is if you tap the ball in, because it's such a tiny increment of time. And so the refs didn't know this rule, and they didn't enforce it. They should never have let the shot go off. They certainly shouldn't have called the foul and given the foul shooter 3 shots to tie the game. Yet, there is no appeals process, and so the result of the game stand. Simon has been protesting, but to no avail. And it looks to me like this just sort of per se rule violation, and it also doesn't make sense to me that after the fact there's no way to dispute the result. But, David, perhaps you disagree.
I have so many interesting, so many, I don't know if they're interesting, so many thoughts on this, which will include a number of questions.
Be the judge of that, Sparky.
First of all, that kid who hit 3 free throws with no time left on the clock.
I know!
You know, ice in that kid's veins.
So, and previously, our team had the same thing had happened. That's how our team had gone up by 3. Our team, Derek, on Simon's team, and I'm sorry, Derek, I don't know your last name, same ice in veins.
Well, but it's different to hit it when your game is tied and hit 3 to put you up 3 than it is when you're down 3. There's no time left. You have to hit all 3. That is
okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is some performance. Did the coach of Wilbercross, your team, say anything to the ref in the moment?
He did not.
Okay. Failure to file any kind of timely protest there.
Well, that was the thing. The only way you can protest is in that very second. Like, once the game restarted, New Haven lost its right to dispute the results.
Yeah. Then I would say the other interesting question to me is there is a point at which you, below which it is understood, you cannot get a shot off. But that doesn't necessarily to me mean that you can't be attempting to take a shot and therefore be fouled while attempting to make a shot. And therefore, it's true that you wouldn't have gotten the shot off. But just because you didn't get the shot off doesn't mean I wasn't hacking at you while you were trying to do this thing, which you were unable to complete.
Then how do you get the shooting foul, right? Like, one.
Right.
Because
you're trying to shoot.
No, but they should have just blown the whistle. Game's over at the point three.
Given them 2 foul shots because they shouldn't have been able to take the shots. That was what the.
I think this is a philosophical. I think this is a philosophical question, which is that you can say if they just let him take the shot, GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.